The ceasefire is over. Fighting has resumed between Israel and Hamas.
The Hamas army of terror in the Gaza Strip violated the terms of the agreed framework and launched rocket fire at Israeli communities.
Plus, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky.
Zelensky says winter's expected to complicate fighting after a summer counter-offensive had failed to produce desired results due to enduring shortages of weapons and ground forces. Despite setbacks, Zelensky says Ukraine is not backing down.
And later, we'll check in with Kyiv and get an update from COP28 in Dubai. Plus, Israelis are buying guns. Lots of them. Today is Friday, December 1st, and this is VOA's Flashpoint, Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Despite diplomatic efforts by Qatar, the U.S. and Egypt, fighting between Israel and Hamas has resumed. In the hour before the truce was set to end at 7 a.m. local time, Israel said it had intercepted a rocket fired from Gaza. There was no immediate comment from Hamas or claim of responsibility for the launch. Elon Levy is a spokesperson for the Israeli government.
This morning, after a seven-day hostage release pause, having failed to provide a list of more hostages for release, the Hamas army of terror in the Gaza Strip violated the terms of the agreed framework and launched rocket fire at Israeli communities. At 5:43 a.m., Hamas fired the first rocket from Gaza, and that rocket fire has since intensified, with sirens blaring across southern Israel all morning, including in communities that are still under mandatory evacuation orders, and in those kibbutzim ethnically cleansed by Hamas during its campaign of systematic extermination on October 7th.
Hamas has said that Israel bears responsibility for the ceasefire ending because Israel rejected offers to continue the release of hostages. Speaking in Dubai, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said that Hamas is responsible for the end of the truce because they committed a terrorist attack at a bus station in Jerusalem on Thursday, killing three people and wounding others. Blinken also said that Hamas began firing rockets before the pause had ended and reneged on commitments it made in terms of releasing certain hostages. Israelis expressed concern over the resumption of fighting, with many saying their country had no choice but to resume the pounding of Gaza. This is Israeli resident Yael Segal.
I'm really worried about that because I know it's a must. It should continue, but on the other hand, all the hostages are in real danger. I hope Hamas will be clever enough to keep the hostages safe and also the innocent citizens of Gaza, that they will be safe also, because Israel usually, you know, send messages before attacks and ask the people to go from this area, but Hamas doesn't let them to do so, and then blames Israel and the victims, which are innocent citizens.
Others seemed less concerned for Gazans. Tanya Rubinstein echoes the opinion of many that for Israelis' return to normal life, Hamas must be destroyed.
It's not a pleasant situation, but in some place I'm glad that the ceasefire was over, and because we really need to finish the work we started, because we're scared to live in our country. It's our country. We have one small Jewish country. We're afraid to go around, to hit by rockets, to have suicide attacks. I just called my friend and I said, I hope we won't get stabbed. We just came for a coffee. We just want to live. We don't have any other place to go.
There is, of course, concern in Gaza too, and also anger, as Israeli war planes resumed the pounding of Gaza and civilians fled for shelter. M. Ali is a Palestinian living in the Gaza Strip.
We know their treachery. They are treacherous. We know that their intention is killing and destroying our homes. What did they achieve with all this, other than killing children? God will have his revenge on that point, not me. They have killed women, destroyed homes, and are wreaking corruption on the world. They blew up our water, our electricity. What for? We have nothing anymore. What is this life?
So we know that fighting has resumed. We also know there is a divide in Israeli public opinion. Some want the war to continue, to destroy Hamas once and for all. Others want killing and violence to stop. And we're hopeful that the recent truce would develop into something larger and longer. To get a sense of the mood in Israel, I'm joined by Ricky Rosen in Tel Aviv.
I think that the Israeli public in general, from right to left, sees no alternative to fighting a war against Hamas. People feel like they can't continue to live under the indefinite threat of rocket attacks coming from Gaza on all parts of the country. Right now, there was just a barrage aimed at the southern city of Ashdod. And also, there would be no option for rebuilding and moving nearly 200,000 evacuees from the areas surrounding Gaza back into their communities. I think there is a divide in public opinion, and it has to do with the diminishing support for Netanyahu, for Prime Minister Netanyahu. There is a big majority now who don't trust that he's handling the war only in consideration of the good of the country. Many suspect that there are political considerations because he is concerned about holding together his coalition. And so he's dependent on the support of hardline far-right ministers and parties in the government who didn't even support this temporary ceasefire for the return of hostages. They are pushing him to continue the war until the end, and he needs their support in order to continue governing.
Well, let me ask this. One of the first things you said was that Israelis feel like they can't live with the threat of Hamas anymore. They want Hamas to be obliterated, want Hamas to go away so that they're not at risk anymore. Does this mean there is a growing appetite for some kind of peace with Palestinians? It would be the Palestinian Authority and perhaps Hamas in terms of a two-state solution or other kind of agreement that gets us beyond all of this violence?
That's the strange kind of disconnect that that you see, especially among Israeli political and military leaders, and also in the general public. There is not a support for the two-state solution. And in fact, there's not really any kind of stated objectives for the day after the war ends. People know that it will be very, very difficult to rebuild Gaza and install some kind of governing authority that instead of Hamas. People know that the Palestinian Authority is not supported by Palestinians in general and is truly incapable of ruling in Gaza instead of Hamas. And the country in general has turned more to the right in the last decade. And I don't think there is a majority of support for a two-state solution. And especially after what the country has gone through on October 7th and afterwards, when the Palestinian Authority supported the actions of Hamas.
Has Hamas or the PA commented publicly on the end of the ceasefire?
They are, of course, Israel blames Hamas for the end of the ceasefire, for rocket fire being directed towards Israel early in the morning, and for no list being provided of potential hostages to be released this evening. And Hamas blames Israel for starting to bomb the southern areas of Gaza specifically in Khan Yunis, early this morning. The Palestinian Health Authority in Gaza has claimed that 60 people were killed since the ceasefire ended this morning, and hundreds wounded. That's been their response.
Final question for you, Ricky. We know that Secretary of State Antony Blinken, when he was visiting with Netanyahu the other day, his message to him was that Israel really needs to take more care to harm fewer civilians if the war goes forward. Is there any resentment in Israel about America dictating how Israel should defend herself?
I think that Israelis in general and the political leadership are so thankful for President Biden really going out on a limb to show support for Israel from the beginning and continuing to express support while many European leaders and, of course, Arab leaders have condemned the continuation of the war. And I think that kind of gratitude on the part of Israelis for both President Biden and Antony Blinken's support will extend to the criticisms that they have of how Israel should conduct the war. At the same time, I think that Prime Minister Netanyahu made clear to Secretary of State Blinken in their meetings yesterday that the Israeli military has to conduct the war in the way that they see fit, and that they have determined that the level of aggression that was exercised before has to continue in order for Hamas to realize that Israel will not stop until Israel determines, and only the Israeli military determines, that they have accomplished the goal of eradicating Hamas.
So we'll leave it there for today. Ricky Rosen reports for the Voice of America in Tel Aviv. Ricky, thanks for your time. Thanks for your reporting.
Thank you.
As we just heard, like people all over the world, many Israelis want to feel safe in their own homes and cities. And for a long time, most did. However, the Hamas terror massacre of October 7th has changed that and convinced tens of thousands of Israeli civilians to get their own guns. Some women's groups worry, though, about the implications. Linda Gradstein reports for VOA from Jerusalem.
Leila Gradsky said she had thought of getting a gun for a while, but what pushed her to finally get one was the events of October 7th, the day Hamas gunmen rampaged through more than 20 Israeli communities and slaughtered 1,200 men, women, and children.
The stories coming out of down south were unbelievable, and the kind of silver lining to it was that the communities did have guns in their homes that were equipped, were able to protect themselves, and it could have been a lot worse had we not been able to.
She came to Caliber 3, a counter-terror and defense training school, to buy a gun and learn how to use it. She bought a Mossberg MC2C for about $1,300 and paid another $150 for the training course. Her first efforts at shooting were not successful, but she quickly improved. Yaakov Tweti moved to Israel from France and lives in a Jerusalem neighborhood on the border of West Bank Palestinian towns. He says he applied for a gun license just 1 week after the October 7th Hamas attack because he wants to protect his wife and two young children at home.
When we saw what happened on October 7th, we decided that next time we need to be stronger and more prepared for any scenario. I always thought about getting a gun.
Gun sales and training at Caliber 3 are up 2,000% since the Hamas attack, says company founder Sharon Gatt. He says the procedure for granting civilian gun licenses is strict.
They apply for the license, then the Ministry of Interior Affairs here in Israel does a background check on them to check they're not criminals, they're not terrorists, they're not psychopaths. Mentally and physically, they're fit to carry a weapon. And if that's okay, then they do an interview with these people. They send them to Caliber 3 so we can check them, train them.
Israel's hardline national security minister, Itamar Ben-Gvir, recently eased the conditions for Israeli civilians to get guns and announced the formation of additional civilian rapid response security teams. Some 250,000 Israelis have applied for licenses, and only four have been refused, according to the Haaretz newspaper. Women's groups worry that the proliferation of guns could lead to their abuse in cases of domestic violence. Ben-Gvir's campaign to arm civilian security teams is separate from his efforts to increase the arming of Jewish settlers in the West Bank. Since October 7th, Jewish settlers have killed at least 9 Palestinians, according to the UN and human rights groups. But even Israelis who don't live in the West Bank settlements or next to the Gaza border say they're concerned about their personal safety. Again, Leila Grotsky.
I wouldn't say it made me feel powerful, more of it gives me a sense of added protection. Like, I know our army and security forces are amazing, but they can't be there in a split second. And so definitely being able to have that measure of control is important.
The events of October 7th have traumatized many Israelis, even if they were not personally affected. And they say they will do whatever they can to make sure it doesn't happen again. Linda Gradstein, VOA News, Jerusalem.
You're listening to Flashpoint, Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. President Volodymyr Zelensky of Ukraine speaks with the Associated Press, and an update from COP28 coming up in a few minutes. Now, we turn our attention to Kyiv. While Russia continues to shell Ukraine with drones and missiles, Ukrainian media and Russian social media channels are reporting on explosions deep inside Russian territory. Plus, Ukrainian reaction to the Ukraine-NATO Council in Brussels. Anna Chernikova in Kyiv has the details.
On December 1st, Russian forces attacked Ukraine with 25 Shahed drones and 2 Kh-59 missiles. The Ukrainian Air Forces confirmed the destruction of 18 of the drones and one missile. The Russian forces targeted the south and east of the country, Mykolaiv, Kherson, Zaporizhia and Dnipropetrovsk regions. The drone attack was conducted from two directions, occupied Crimea and from Primorsko-Ahtarsk in Russia. The rockets were launched from the airspace of the occupied Kherson region. No casualties or damage have been reported. Meanwhile, Ukrainian media reported that a train with fuel exploded on the Baikal-Amur railway line in eastern Siberia in Russia as a result of a special operation of the Security Service of Ukraine. According to the preliminary information, this was the second detonation aiming to disable this important railway line that Russians use for military logistics. According to the Russian Telegram channels, 6 tanks were on fire due to the explosion. VOA cannot verify this information independently at this time. Following the meeting with colleagues from NATO in Brussels, the Minister of the Foreign Affairs of Ukraine, Dmytro Kuleba, told the Ukrainian public that the NATO countries do not show any signs of fatigue from the Russian war against Ukraine.
A clear no to fatigue and a clear yes to continued and increased support to Ukraine. And it's striking to see this spirit and of unity in the room on these two issues.
Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
Sticking with the crisis in Ukraine for a minute, in an exclusive interview with the Associated Press, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says the war with Russia is entering a new stage as winter looms. The AP's Charles de Ledesma reports.
У нас нова фаза війни, і це факт.
Zelensky says winter's expected to complicate fighting after a summer counter-offensive had failed to produce desired results due to enduring shortages of weapons and ground forces. Despite setbacks, Zelensky says Ukraine is not backing down. Ukraine's president also says he fears the Israel-Hamas war threatens to overshadow the conflict in Ukraine as competing political agendas and limited resources put the flow of Western military aid to Kyiv at risk. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
And finally today, the UN Weather Agency said on Thursday that 2023 is all but certain to be the hottest year on record and warned of increasing floods, wildfires, glacier melt, and heat waves in the future. The worrisome report comes as world leaders meeting for the COP28 climate conference in Dubai have bemoaned the pain of a planet in peril. VOA's Lori London reports.
Kicking off Friday's parade of VIP speakers, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said climate change should be front and center in the minds of global leaders.
The climate challenge is not just another issue in your inbox. Protecting our climate is the world's greatest test of leadership.
He urged delegates to work toward a future without fossil fuels, saying there's no other way to curb global warming.
We cannot save a burning planet via fire hose of fossil fuels. We must accelerate a just, equitable transition to renewables. The science is clear.
Many of the leaders speaking represent countries hard hit by widespread flooding, storms, drought, and heat waves worsened by climate change from burning of coal, oil, and gas. Kenyan President William Ruto said turning Africa into a green powerhouse is not just essential for the continent, it's also vital for global industrialization and decarbonization.
We are here to affirm our commitment to provide robust support to those of us who have contributed least to climate change, yet bear its most catastrophic impacts. As Africa, we are ready to play our part in full. We cannot afford to neglect the immense potential or ignore the pressing needs of a continent on the cusp of transformative growth.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, speaking at the event on food systems and climate, says extreme weather threatens to add to the 700 million people who are already chronically undernourished.
This challenge is only going to get worse. A growing population means the global demand for food is likely to increase by an estimated 50% by the year 2050. An escalating climate crisis means that crop yields could drop by as much as 30% over that same period. So, do the math.
Also in attendance, Britain's King Charles, who made a strong plea for progress and urged leaders to actually follow up on climate commitments.
In 2050, our grandchildren won't be asking what we said. They will be living with the consequences of what we did or didn't do. So if we act together to safeguard our precious planet, the welfare of all our people will surely follow.
He told delegates survival depends on reversing what he calls the frightening experiment of outpacing nature's ability to cope.
Harmony with nature must be maintained. The earth does not belong to us. We belong to the earth.
Also in attendance and watching closely, conservation organizations, institutes, businesses, and young environmentalists like Julia Hoffman, who says the climate crisis is personal.
One way or another, nature is going to reclaim this planet, and I would much rather it be side by side with humans than without us. My hometown of Shanghai is always first on the list of cities that will soon be underwater.
Lori London, VOA News, Washington.
And that's going to wrap up today's program. There is more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until next week, I'm Steve Karish.
Stay up to date with VOA Podcasts. Each weekday, International Edition covers the world's biggest stories, while Flashpoint Iran and Flashpoint Ukraine examine their respective regions in depth every week.